Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, chapter 2, entitled Divinity and Divine Service, text number 19. Tadarajastano bhava
Tadarajastano bhava
Kamalo bhadiyaschaye
Kamalo bhadiyaschaye
Chetaitir anavidam
Chetaitir anavidam
Stitam satvi prasidati
Stitam satvi prasidati.
Translation: as soon as irrevocable loving service is established in the heart, the effects of nature's motive passion and ignorance, such as lust, desire, and hankering, disappear from the heart. Then the devotee is established in goodness, and he becomes completely happy. A living being in his normal constitutional position is fully satisfied in spiritual bliss. This state of existence is called Brahma Bhuta or Atmanandi, or the state of self-satisfaction. This self-satisfaction is not like the satisfaction of the inactive fool. The inactive fool is in the state of foolish ignorance, whereas the self-satisfied Atmanandi is transcendental to the material state of existence. This state of perfection is attained as soon as one is fixed in irrevocable devotional service. Devotional service is not inactivity, but the unalloyed activity of the soul. The soul's activity becomes adulterated in contact with matter, and as such, the diseased activities are expressed in the form of lust, desire, hankering, inactivity, foolishness, and sleep. The effect of devotional service becomes manifest by complete elimination of these effects of passion and ignorance. The devotee is fixed at once in the mode of goodness, and he makes further progress to rise to the position of Vasudeva, or the state of unmixed sattva or sudha-sattva. Only in this sudha-sattva state can one always see Krishna eye to eye by dint of pure affection for the Lord. A devotee is always in the mode of unalloyed goodness, therefore he harms no one. But the non-devotee, however educated he may be, is always harmful. A devotee is neither foolish nor passionate. The harmful, foolish, and passionate cannot be devotees of the Lord. However, they may advertise themselves as devotees by outward dress. A devotee is always qualified with all the good qualities of God. Quantitatively, such qualifications may be different, but qualitatively, both the Lord and his devotees are one and the same. Om Agyanati Marandasya Gyanandana Salakya Shakshurin Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitana Manobhistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Pradamayam Radati Svapadantikam Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sivasari Gaura Bhaktarinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna. Is it okay now? Otherwise, I have a very loud voice. I mean, really. I can do without also. Everyone in this material world is conditioned by the material energy since time immemorial. That means anadi bhavi mukha. We cannot trace out how long we have been in the material world. And life after life, we are changing bodies. That is to say, we're changing the gross bodies. But the mind, or the subtle body, made of mind, intelligence, and false ego, is traveling with us life after life, as long as we are taking bodies in the material world. Therefore, the impressions of so many lifetimes are stored within our consciousness. But by the arrangement of the Supreme Lord, we have forgotten these previous lives. But all the memories of the previous lives are stored within the subconsciousness. And subconsciously, they are influencing us. So many lives. Therefore, a cute little child is not just totally innocent, because there is a whole history there which may not just be manifest as yet, but which comes out after a little while. And then, and then you think, but how is it possible that my little darling is doing such a thing, but your little darling has already done these things in unlimited previous lives? So in this way, we are very much influenced by the three modes of material nature, which spread out over many, many lifetimes. Srila Prabhupada is mentioning that we should associate with the mode of goodness. He doesn't say we should be in the mode of goodness. He says we should associate with the mode of goodness, which is, I think, an interesting point, because if someone says you must be in the mode of goodness, and we're all trying goodness, 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 my goodness, how are we going to ever be in the mode of goodness? It's not so easy. Just by determination or by endeavor, we cannot really change our heart. But by associating with the mode of goodness, one gradually develops the qualities of goodness. However, here in Srimad Bhagavatam, the transcendental process of devotional service is described. And it is said, by devotional service, automatically the influence of ignorance and passion disappears. And then, eventually, one becomes fixed in goodness, and even in pure goodness, unalloyed goodness, known as visuddhisattva, transcendental goodness. Meanwhile, we are in the process of purification, and the influence of the lower modes of nature are still there. And due to the influence of the lower modes of material nature, some bad habits may be there. On one train journey, I saw opposite of me two young school girls, 12, maybe, something like that. And they looked so innocent. So in my mind, I was thinking, innocent young girls, while I'm chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. And then they started a conversation, and then one says to the other, "Hee hee hee. Are you also sometimes drinking whiskey?" He 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 he. I go, 12 years old, drinking whiskey? What happened to my innocent little girls? So this is the nature of the material world. Because we were already afflicted with sinful behavior in previous lives, the tendency is there once again. And then, when we are in an environment where such association is there, then the inclination to act in a sinful way is very strong. We were studying the pastime of Dhruva Maharaj, and we may recall how Dhruva Maharaj was the son of Maharaj Uttanapad, who was the son of Swayambhuva Manu. And Dhruva wanted to sit on the lap of his father, but the king was married to two wives, and the young one, the most attractive one, her son, was sitting on the lap of the king. And when she saw that Dhruva also wanted to sit there, she said, "No, no, no, you can't sit on the lap of the king, no, 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 no. Only those who have taken birth from my womb can sit on the lap of the king." So if you want to sit there, that's all right. But first, you'll have to give up this body and take birth from my womb. Then you can sit there. So, okay, Dhruva became a little angry about that, we remember. And he complained. He went complaining to his mother, and his mother said, well, what can we do? She is the king's favorite. What a drama. Interesting is when we look at Dhruva's previous life. And it said that in his previous life, Dhruva was a brahmana. And as a brahmana, he was the advisor of a king. And this king had great opulence and so on. And at one point, this brahmana developed a desire to also have a kingdom in great opulence, just like the king that he was serving as a minister. And then in his next life, he became Dhruva. And then that same desire came out to have a kingdom. And there were all kinds of external circumstances. He wasn't allowed to sit on the lap of his father. He was a Kshatriya, and therefore, naturally, he couldn't tolerate such an insult. And therefore, naturally, he wanted revenge, which Kshatriyas do. And he wanted a kingdom greater than his father. So, and grandfather, by the way, Swayambhuva Manu, had a big one. So, you know, so we kind of saw how it was all logical, Dhruva's behavior from the situation that he was in this life. But it's interesting that behind it was another life which was kind of already giving him, in a dormant state, that desire to have a kingdom. And then it was reconfirmed by the present situation. I thought, when I read that, I thought that was very interesting. To look at people, we often look at people how they are a product of their environment. That's a very modern thing to do. Any psychologist will immediately do that. When we are writing someone's biography, we're also looking at, like, how was this person responding to the circumstances of his time? And we place everything in historical context. But just see how the influence of previous lives is still affecting us now. And how these invisible influences may be there in the choices that we make today. And I think that's important for a devotee to understand, because in that way we can maybe take these strong desires not so serious. We can basically see Dhruva had this strong desire for a kingdom, but it was partially fueled by the mistake of last life. So why make that mistake again? I met a brahmachari. This is a story from the perspective of a brahmachari. So brahmacharis don't want to get married. That's something they're trying to avoid. So don't take it that I'm speaking out against marriage. I'm all for marriage, as long as it doesn't involve me. So we don't create misunderstandings. Anyway, this brahmachari went to an astrologer, and the astrologer said, oh, next year will be a very difficult year, because next year you will meet your wife from last life. And then what you're going to do? He came to me for counseling, you know, and I gave him a brahmachari ashram, a brahmachari answer, and the answer was like, well, you married her last life, why would you do it again? Okay. Anyway, the point, the underlying point, and the more important point, is that we are simply being influenced by so many lifetimes of conditioning. of attachments that we develop and that we carry with us, and they very much govern our present life. How serious can one take that? No, but just these strong and deep desires I have. It's very deep. It's me, you know. It's not you. It's just conditioning from last life. Right? It's not that this is our identity. It is actually an identity that has been superimposed upon our identity. An artificial identity. An identity which has come about due to association with the material energy. You see, just by association, we have developed attachment, and now this attachment is still with us, and forcing us to make choices that are that mean a lot to us, and that where we strongly feel this is me, and actually this is not the case. Rather, our true identity remains hidden underneath all these layers of material conditioning. That true identity is we cannot access at present. We have no idea who we really are in the spiritual world, what our eternal identity truly is. It's hard to say. For that matter, a truck driver with tattoos all over might be a gopi in the spiritual world. That is possible. And the ballerina could be a cowherd boy in the spiritual world. It's like our current situation is not necessarily the same. So it's hard to say.
Yeah. Who's who? Some bake. Gorilla.
May not be a gorilla in the spiritual world. So that's interesting. So therefore, in our current condition in devotional service, we are not taking our material desires so seriously. We are observing them and we are judging. Are these going to get me into trouble or not? If they're not going to get me in too much trouble, all right, maybe I'll pursue them. But if they'll get me into trouble, no. Then I will definitely have to give them up. That is a prerequisite in devotional service. One has to have that willingness to say, some of my desires I will forego. On the other hand, the topic comes up of being natural. And naturalness is an important quality. How can we be artificial? And how long can we be artificial? If we place ourselves in a condition of life which is very artificial and we are always suppressing our nature, then we are at risk. And then you can have, like what they call in psychology, a Schattendurchbruch. They use many German words in psychology, which means a shadow breakthrough. And how suddenly somewhere out of the dark side of the mind, some very strong urge breaks through. Psychologists are having a field day with these kind of things. To be natural is something that is emphasized and is important. And we agree in Krishna consciousness. Naturalness is an essential element of Krishna consciousness. Krishna consciousness is not a process of Srila Prabhupada said, not an artificial imposition on the mind. It is a natural process. But there must be a marriage. And the marriage must be between naturalness and purity. These two have to be married. That is important. Right? Alone, you're not going to make it. Right? Either one needs the other. Naturalness and purity come together. And then we get the proper results, the proper offspring. This we find explained by Srila Kavikarnapur in his Chaitanya Chandradoya Natak, which is a drama, a biographical drama about Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, including something like more than 70 personalities. And so it's quite a big work. Srila Prabhupada has classified it as an authorized biography at the same time in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. So it's interesting drama. It's whatever is in there is authorized. So there's an interesting mix of different qualities. At the end it is stated that naturalness and purity are together, and they are they're part of bhakti, they're essential to bhakti. So we need purification, that we understand the lower nature is not the true nature of the living being. Unfortunately, the lower nature predominates a lot of social life.
Yeah, we go in the pub and you know, we throw down a vat of beer.
That's the lower nature. The lower nature is very much part of the social life. It's like, you know, I grew up in the Netherlands, and it's sort of a place where also there are a few activities going on which are not really found in holy scriptures, or not recommended at least. Sometimes they're mentioned as the gateway to hell, but not really, not as recommended activities. But then you get kids in your school that say, come on, you know, come on, don't be square, you know, come on, you know, you try this, you know what I mean? And they try to convince you to take drugs. And at that point, someone might think, yeah, well, I guess, you know, whereas anybody with a little bit of intelligence can appreciate that these things are bringing only misery. So the modes of ignorance surround us. There are traces of the mode of ignorance within us. From early age we are being influenced before we can even fully make informed decisions, right? Mature decisions. We are already influenced by our environment. Therefore, possibly we are carrying a few things in our hand luggage, but you know how it is, the airlines are ruthless, especially a certain one that's very cheap. They are ruthless, they will not allow you to carry it on, right? And but when one is determined, right, when one is very determined, even the heaviest security team will not stop us from carrying it all on. We simply get a heavy overcoat with many pockets and pack it up, and somehow or other, we'll carry on the extra 20 kilos. So, in the same way in spiritual life, we have been told that we must give up our material attachments. The tenth offense against the holy name is the main thing, material attachment. Yes, we know that one. Don't like it. But anyway, fortunately, there is a word called dovetailing. It's a great word. It's a wonderful thing, dovetailing. Somehow or other, whatever attachment you have, you just have to somehow or other engage it in the service of Krishna. Even if it is 3 minutes a year and the rest of the year is all for you. So, yes, in this way, We must be, when we are thinking about purification, there must be some inherent fear in the devotee of the material energy. The material energy is depicted in different ways. I like the picture of Ganga Devi. If you ever seen like the painting of Ganga as a female form, and it is said that Ganga, she is riding on a crocodile. I always find that interesting. That, you know, these demigods, they're riding on different animals, and her vehicle is a crocodile. Why is Ganga riding on a crocodile? An interesting question. Well, because Ganga comes into the material world and she's like riding on the material energy. So that material energy is represented by the crocodile. So what about crocodiles? There are stories that people in New York keep crocodiles as a pet, and when they grow up, that they put them in the New York sewer, and that there are crocodiles living there underground in New York City. There are stories like that. Yes. Because, and it might be true, because when you keep a crocodile as a pet, it's one thing when it's a little crocodile, but as the croc grows up and the teeth are growing, there is a problem, because there is no such thing as taming a croc. Never ever can you trust a croc. A croc is always a croc, if you know what I mean. And can bite any moment, and there goes a leg, a hand, or other more important parts even. So crocodiles are treacherous. They stand for being treacherous, being totally untrustworthy. So it's very interesting that the material energy is depicted like a crocodile, I find. Because that's basically what we're dealing with. The material energy cannot be trusted. One cannot think, I have it under control. No problem. I have now arranged the material circumstances in such a way that, you know, I don't have to worry about it. I don't have to worry about it. Yeah, no problem. No problem at all. I'm safe. No, one must always be on guard in the material world. That is basically the injunction of the scripture. Padam, padam, yad vipadam, nate sam. Danger at every step. And the greatest danger is svalpam apiyasya dharmasya trayate mahato bayat. Greatest danger is that we may again fall down in the material world. And Srila Prabhupada made that point, that he said, the biggest problem is that you are not sufficiently afraid of Maya. So that's why I'm emphasizing the point. So a devotee must be careful and, all right. Sometimes we have to ask, do I really need this in the service of Krishna? If not, maybe I shouldn't bother. Because there's no end. There's no end to the material energy. And one thing leads to another. Alright, enough about that. So in the initial stages in devotional service, there is an element of self-control. There is an element of renunciation, an element of choosing for simple life rather than stretching the limits of the envelope. Yeah. For example, there are two approaches. One approach is that if we don't need it, we won't use it. It's the renounced one. The other one is like, well, if it's not forbidden, why wouldn't we use it? I mean, these two approaches there are in spiritual life. And I guess, you know, most of us would be well situated somewhere in between. I mean, it's like either extreme may be difficult, you know, if we don't need it, we won't use it sometimes, you know, come on, you know, we're human after all. And the other side, well, you know, if it's not forbidden, why not? Yeah, but one thing leads to the next. That's the thing, you know. It's like I said, if you just always take it to the edge, if you always walk on the edge, then, well, you know, once there, this. So in this way, a devotee is trying to take a secure position. Therefore, every devotee must be in an ashram. There was one devotee, he was a bachelor, a typical bachelor. He had a studio, an all-in-one in one studio. And as a bachelor, every chair was stacked up with magazines and books and things like that. And a typical bachelor flat, right? I mean, if you wanted to sit somewhere, you had to sort of move things over, right, to get a spot. And that's kind of bachelor life, right? But one day I asked him, I said, like, what's your ashram? He said, like, I'm not married, you know what I mean? You know, I said, that's true. I said, but you're also not a brahmachari, right? Because, like, why would you have a flat, you know, in the first place with all these things in it, right? So, you should choose an ashram. Yeah. And eventually he chose an ashram, and I won't tell you which one. Yeah. But the point is that we do need to choose an ashram, because an ashram gives us a code of behavior, a prescribed code of behavior. And that leads us to the mode of goodness. And as we are situating ourselves in these codes of behavior relating to the ashram, we at least have a basis of goodness. And then it's easier to practice devotional service. If we practice devotional service from a platform of the mode of passion, I mean, usually I'm totally in the mode of passion, and like I want to enjoy like so many things, you know, liters of ice cream, and you know, like, I mean, is there cheese sabji? Is there any cheese sabji? Like that. Passion, you know. I mean, what are we doing today? You know, I mean, God, are we doing something today? I'm getting like, I'm exploding. There's nothing going on. The mode of passion is difficult. Of course, when you are in the mode of passion, then one can engage very passionately in devotional service, right? And okay, you know, what are we gonna do? We're gonna scrub down the whole temple today. Like, okay, if that's finished, you know, we got like 40 kilos of potatoes to peel, you know, like, I mean, okay, like, let's get into it. And sort of like, okay, after that we can. So one can passionately engage in devotional service and this way purify the passion. That is possible. But still, it's risky if one has such a passionate nature. There is the risk that sometimes one may snap out of the role, if you know what I mean. Oops, you know. One who is in passion tends to act before they think, you know what I mean? And obviously, it's better to think before one acts, and we have to kind of. So we have to cultivate a mode of goodness, to think before we act. Yeah. And then, from a platform of goodness, we can engage in devotional service. And this will really purify all that passion, and we'll lose the desire to enjoy the material energy. Sometimes we may see someone who is supposed to be advanced acting in what looks very passionate. And, you know, all that. No, passion means the desire to enjoy the material energy. Like, there is one country, it's very beautiful, super clean, and they have nice white picket fences and green lawns and these flower boxes over the window, and it just looks like very, very wonderful. Everything is clean. There's no garbage, nothing in the whole country to be found. One might think that this place, when you first see it, you might think this is in the mode of goodness. No, it's not. This is in the mode of passion. Yeah? Because it's the perfect place for enjoyment. All those green lawns, all those neat pathways, all those white picket fences, all those lovely little houses with the flower boxes under the windows and so on are simply made for one person. To enjoy the sense of. And that's Maya, what can be said. Sorry. But in spiritual life, we are rising above sense enjoyment by higher taste. Not that one day by engaging in devotional service, I'll just be free from all these desires. Yeah. I become very advanced, now I have no more desires. That's obviously, spiritual life means the desires become purified and now start to relate to Krishna. Yes. Like that story of the thief that Prabhupada told. A thief who heard a story, a Bhagavatam story about Krishna. Near Govardhan, there was a Bhagavatam lecture and the speaker began to describe how Krishna is decorated with so many wonderful jewels. And this thief just walks by and he heard the magic word, jewels. Jewel. So he walked into the lecture and he heard a little more. And he heard all these descriptions about Krishna and how he had all these jewels. And then at the end of the lecture, he went up to the speaker and he said, that person, Krishna, you were talking about, sounds like a really interesting person. I'd really like to meet him. Jewels. Where can I meet him? Oh, he stays somewhere on the side of Govardhan, said the man. So, all right, you know, thief went looking around at Govardhan. He had his ears out, looking everywhere for Krishna. So it is said that one day he saw him, he met him. He saw Krishna there at the side of Govardhan. He couldn't mistake him, jewels everywhere, and decorated and so on. So he went up to Krishna and he said, Charu, 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 please, please, Charu. I'm telling a story. So in the middle of the story, we were just in Govardhan. The thief found Krishna with all the jewels. So he goes up to Krishna and he says, give me some of those jewels. Krishna says, no, I can't do that. Mother Yasoda will become very upset. No. The thief wouldn't hear no for an answer and just start taking them. And he started just taking all the jewels. Krishna let him take. Then the thief had all the jewels and thinking, you know, I mean, that's a glorious moment in a thief's life, right? That's like when you finally make it big, you know what I mean? Your whole life, you're just thinking about, like, you know, the big one, right? The big one, the really big one, you know, like the train robbery or something extraordinary, big. So finally, you know, like, he did it, you know, he did it, he made it, I made it, you know what I mean? The one steal that, like, you know, that for life, you know, puts you up, that one. He had all the jewels. And then he had it, and then he think, The thought came, when you achieve your goal in life, your ultimate dream in life, then it's quite common to think, now what? Yeah? So that's what happened to him. He thought, now what? And standing there with all these jewels, what am I going to do with all these jewels? And then somehow or other he saw Krishna. And something sparked off in his heart and he was thinking, you know, I could do so many things with these jewels. But oh, who cares about all of these things? Make a huge castle, go here, go there. The most wonderful thing I could possibly do with these jewels is decorate Krishna. And then he said to Krishna, would it be right if I decorate you with these jewels? And Krishna said, yeah, sure, go ahead. So then, you know, like he went for, he got into it, you know. No, this one, that one there. Whole thing, you know. And that night, Krishna came home and Mother Yasoda said, what happened to your dress? Right? I mean, I didn't dress you like that. Krishna said, oh, one of my devotees did that. Yeah. So it's, Prabhupada actually tells the story, and it's a really nice story showing how devotional service works. It's not about giving up all these things. It's about becoming attracted to Krishna more and more, and then using all the things for Krishna. But in the meanwhile, while we're not attracted to Krishna, they say Krishna is all attractive, but sometimes it looks like Maya is all attractive. So in that stage, we'd better still be on guard and keep ourselves on the safe platform until our natural attraction to Krishna begins to develop more and more. Then gradually we rise above the modes of material nature until stittam sattva prasidati, until we become situated in pure goodness and we are prasidati. Siddhati means satisfied or happy, and pra means prakrista rupena, means in its complete form. So that means completely, totally happy, which is not bad. And then there's no space for any other desire, because one is totally happy. See, when we're a little bit not totally happy, that's when we are in danger. So maybe that's our present state. If someone asks you, are you happy in Krishna consciousness? We say, yes. And we can give reasons. I'm happy because, you know, I know that whatever I do will produce good results. I'm happy because I know I'm doing the right thing, you know what I mean? It makes you feel good. It's true. I was reading about self-esteem in some psychology book, and it said that when you engage in activities which you are considering as the highest good, then automatically you start to feel good. And I liked it because I thought, hey, that's us, you know, that's us, that's how it works. We are engaging in activities that we hold as the highest good, and therefore we feel good. But maybe there's still here and there a little sense of struggle, a little sense of austere, probably, austere spiritual life. And therefore, maybe there's still a slight little back door, you know, that like opens up to the back garden of Maya. So, okay. So with a balance, in a balanced way, we are progressing. Pessimistic about material life and very optimistic about spiritual life. Blessing to ever increasing happiness. Okay, I'll stop. Questions or comments are most welcome.
an approach to be balanced. How do we know if we're near the edge or not? We may not see what the edge is, but we might be really near it, or we might be really far from it, so we could have maybe...
Well, in the beginning, it's like that, you know. In the beginning in spiritual life, the question is, where is the edge? Then we get more experience by practicing, and we sort of begin to figure out our limitations, and we begin to realize, we know, I'm not so strong. We recognize I'm still attracted to certain things, so when I'm attracted to these things, I will keep a little distance from these tempting situations. In that way, one keeps a distance from the edge by keeping a distance from tempting situations. So later on the danger is not so much like where is the edge, it's just the tendency of becoming a little slack anyway, you know what I mean? And then your friends take it to the edge, you know. Everybody does it, we're human after all, pure devotees yet, and all the justifications to kind of be a little slack. But therefore we get reminders about crocodiles, because if you want to be slack with a crocodile, you might lose a few fingers. So that's the thing. So gradually we become more experienced. And balance is something I learned from Bhurijan Prabhu, who is very wise. And he gave an example which I thought is very good, that balance is something like riding a bicycle. There's no position while you're riding the bicycle where you've got your balance. It can't say, now we've got a balance. It's not one position. It's constant adjustment. That's what it is. So balance is about making adjustments. Okay, now we're a bit too much on that side. All right, put a little bit on that side. All right, a bit too much on the other side. Put a little bit on this side. So balance means always balancing. So by always balancing ourselves, we find a balance. I thought that's very deep and good point, important point. Any other question? Yes.
Maharaj, you talked about how in the beginning of the class, how everything that's happening to us in this life has some history from a past life or can be linked to it. So when we're going in life and certain things happen to us, how are we to understand what Krishna's trying to teach us from this? Because we can speculate a lot. So like, if we become deep and try to understand what Krishna's trying to teach us, how do we come to those conclusions?
The material world is sometimes presented as an educational model, a place where we have to learn a lesson, and that this life is meant for that purpose, and that really Krishna is trying to teach us something in this life. So it's in that model that we are now kind of thinking, and when one thinks like that, then one can see in the events that take place that Krishna is trying to teach us through these events. And one may wonder, what's he trying to teach me? All right, and things happen. And sometimes things go wrong. And especially when things go wrong, we tend to become reflective. Right? Why is this happening? You know, why this thing is happening to me? And what am I to learn from this? And we can, of course, there's no point in trying to go back to previous lives, you know, to try and find out what was I, what did I do in my previous life, and maybe I should go under hypnosis and this, that, and you know, it is there. Bir Krishnamurti is doing these things, and he did that with a group of devotees in Germany, and he told some. And there were some brahmacharis, and he told the brahmacharis, and you might be surprised, you know, that in your last life, you were a female, right? Brahmachari. And then he said, look at your feet. And this one brahmachari looks at his feet, and he had red shoes on, you know. And he goes, oh my God, you know. And then he remembered a whole life, you know. A whole life. In a female body with the children and the whole family and everything, the whole story came back, and all the frustrations and all the hopes and what didn't work out, and the kids never became what they wanted them to become, and this and that. And okay, fine, you know. And what's behind that life, and behind that life, and behind that life, and behind all the other lives? There's no end to it. Right? So digging in previous lives is not really what is required. It's just that all these lives have now culminated in a quality. We have developed a quality. Because of a certain behavior in previous life, we may, for example, have developed a quality of pride. And then Krishna, to teach us, may create circumstances which cut down that pride. So first you rise to glory, and then suddenly, bang, it's all gone. And then it's like, ah! Right? So in this way, one has to simply look at the quality. What is Krishna trying to teach me here? I gave an example of pride, and someone suddenly loses everything and then is humble, right? Loses his... All right, then one has to say, all right, Krishna wants me to develop humility. Or someone may experience how anger is getting out of hand. I myself had an experience as a kid which stayed with me my whole life. There was a boy in school who just was, for a joke, he says to me, what do you think of this joke? And then he pokes with a finger in my eye, like that. Well, you know, I got angry beyond myself, right? I mean, it was like, I got so angry that I twisted his arm and smacked him against the wall. And I was really in destruction mode, I must say. And he broke his arm. Yeah? He broke his arm. And then he started to scream really loud. And I ran, you know. And the whole school, all the kids ran after me. But I outran them all. I could run very fast. So I was running very fast. And I shook him off, but then I came back in school later in the afternoon, and then the director was there, and I was the criminal. And I thought it wasn't fair because the guy was it poked me in the eye. But anyway, he broke his arm. Oh God, what a drama. First at school, then at home, my father, and you know, and the insurance policy is going up in this day. Okay, to make it worse, in the same week I kicked a football through the main glass window, you know. Okay. Yeah. And 1 month later there was some work on the road, and there was a pump and a pipe, and they had like some planks. And I was just showing to my brother a flying bicycle trick when this old lady decided to come out of the walkway of her house. And she also broke her arm. So it was a total disaster year. It's like, in like a couple of in the span of two, three months, you know, it was just one big disaster. And it sort of stayed with me my whole life, you know. Like, one is, I controlled anger after that. Yeah? It's like really controlled anger. Now. It's like, kind of, okay, anger is something. Watch out with anger, you know, control that. I controlled that, and also I didn't do any more flying bicycle tricks since then. I've never done one again. You know? Watch out for old ladies. I got that also. So we do learn certain things in life, right, which help us to control the qualities that arise from the modes of material nature. And that is sufficient. So rather than looking at what is the cause, what is the cause, what is the cause, why do I have this anger? And you know what I mean? And maybe in my last life I already had this anger problem, and if I go back to the last life, then I will solve it, you know. Well, okay, probably in the last life you did have an anger problem, and probably you didn't solve it, right? So, you know, are you going to solve it now or what, you know? Or are you going to wait till the next life again, right? It's time to solve it now, right? Don't wait till it gets out of hand. Just solve it now. Yes. So anger is meant to be controlled. So in this way, we learn through circumstances. The Prabhupada points out, better learn through hearing. That is the first class approach. Learn through hearing. One who is less intelligent has to learn through experience. One who has no brain at all, even after experience, still doesn't learn. Anything between your ears? I don't know. I thought so. You knock on the head and there's a lot of hollow space there. So we're supposed to learn from hearing and learn from experience. And for most of us, we learn through a combination of the two. I must admit that in my life also, in many cases, learning by the circumstances and then the scriptures give the purport. Oftentimes the scriptures gave the purport to the lesson I learned from the circumstances. But a very wise person can just immediately learn from the scriptures. Krishna may still give us a confirmation after that. So we understood, yes, you must be humble, and then Krishna will give us in real life situations where we're forced to be humble, just to reconfirm, yes, you really have to be humble. And you'll test us. Okay, we're coming to the end. Unless someone has a burning question. It's not that bad, it's warm. No question. I've been too clear again. All right, then we'll leave it at that.
Oh, there is one.
There is one. Hey, you're hiding.
All right, I hear a lot about dog-pain desires. But if we sometimes actually analyze what majority of desires that people have, we might find that majority of them might not be able to be dog-pain. So what do you do about them?
Kill them. What to do? Now, it's like, you know, the fact that you can dovetail some, that compensates for the ones that you just have to give up. Yeah. So you just have to give up 100% of your desires. That's getting tough. But if at least you get like one toy, then you can sort of tolerate that you don't get all the other 100 toys. Yeah. At least you got one good toy. Yeah. What is it anyway, Charles? An X-ray machine or what? A video camera. Oh dear. Fancy. Yeah, so like that. You can have one video camera and then, yeah, okay then.
A video camera. real.
Then you can say goodbye to the iPad.
It's not a thing, then ordinary video camera, it's a real video camera.
I see, yeah. I'll start smiling then, eh? Wow. It makes real noises too. Oh no. It clicked. You took a picture now. Oh no. I gotta put on my glasses. But you see the point. So the license, you know, in spiritual life is that there are authorized material desires and unauthorized material desires. By trying to satisfy the authorized material desires, then we get some sense enjoyment there, which may still be entangling and still give us, you know, distress. Just like you may think, I want to get married. Okay, you get married and I love and all that, you know, and it's like, and then, you know, and from one thing comes another and, you know, embraces. But then in the end, there could be a child. And then my question is, why children don't sing when they come out of the womb? See, something is built in, right? That babies cry. And it's intense, right? So there is something where you think like, well, I mean, obviously there is an element in the design where which brings you to the point like, why am I doing all this? Huh? If babies would be singing beautiful, then you say like, let's have more babies. It would. So there is some discouragement built in the design of the material world. Yeah? And many other types of material. So even while we're trying to satisfy some material desires, we'll get a taste of, well, maybe it's not as good as I thought it was. And then we'll become materially exhausted. Okay? That's the next stage. I say, oh, well, I guess, why bother? So that's also there. But our movement is not one where you have to just rigidly give up all your material desires. You simply have to satisfy Krishna. And then he'll take you back to Godhead. Of course, when we go into the spiritual world, we have to be free from material desires. But Lord Chaitanya is very kind. He may take us and just purify our material desires. Okay, well, I'll leave it at that.